When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. I'm here with my good friend, Mark. How are you this week, Mark?
I'm quite well, Walker. How are you?
Very good.
Do you know what day it is today?
What day is it?
There are several holidays today. One of them isn't really a holiday. It's one of the complimentary days. In year 232 of the French Republican calendar, today is the Fête de la Vertu. So happy celebration of virtue day, Walker. It is also, perhaps more relevantly, Mexican Independence Day. So happy Mexican Independence Day, Walker.
Mark, see, I would know this, Mark, if I had a French calendar that marked all the French holidays.
I will point out that in the French Republican calendar that I have, it does not acknowledge Mexican Independence Day. One can perhaps understand why.
Might be a little contentious.
Yes, but we're coming up to the end of year 232 in the French Republican calendar. Of course, everyone knows that because we're celebrating the complimentary days.
Duh.
Do you have your year 233 French Republican calendar ready? I do.
One for every room. First, we're going to talk about the Eurus, the game we reviewed exactly 1 year ago. Then we're going to talk about the games we played this week. Then the news and why it doesn't matter. And then our topic for the week, which is replayability. Mark, what did we review exactly 1 year ago?
Audubon by Fabio Lopiano and Nestore Mangione, published by Alley Cat Games. This is a game about, you know, the Audubon. It's got a lovely two-phase structure in that before the Berlin Wall goes down and then after the Berlin Wall goes down, you're developing the Audubon and dropping off service stations, which is always Walker's monomaniacal focus. You're running trucking companies as well as building roads. It is a medium-heavy Euro. Fabio Lopiano has done a number of things. We're big fans of Kalamala being the foremost among them. But Audubon was a considerable jump in both complexity and playtime. And thus, I was very, very gratified to enjoy it as much as I did. I don't know that Fabio Lopiano's output, both in terms of scope and in terms of focus, quite puts him in the same category as the other Italian masters, like Luciani, like Tascini, like people of that, or even Architocca. But this was very uncharacteristic of in his previous publications, and we've played it a bunch of times since. It's probably one of your favorite Euros of the past few years.
Exactly. I've kept it, going to keep it. It does this great mechanism where you're playing cards that are associated with colors. So now you can build roads purple. So now you can build any roads, but they have to be in purple or put out gas stations. It's color-coded, and you have to have – it's one of these things where you pull the cards back, and so you sort of have to – figure things out and time it against other people and time it based on where you're going to have roads, where you can put gas stations. It's very interesting. Great game.
My one observation, this isn't even a criticism, but it's an observation. I don't think I'm in a position to give strategy advice to anyone about anything, really, much of the time. The minor exception for Audubon. One of the things about Audubon that people find very disorienting, I think, is the way scoring works. Scoring in Audubon is actually shockingly simple and straightforward. There's a lot of stuff going on, and you should indeed interact with all those sub-mechanisms. But people often have this experience, I see this sometimes in Euro games, where they're middling around in the sandbox and not paying any attention to the final scoring conditions. And they're doing well in the sense that they're doing lots of things, they're laying out lots of stuff, they're triggering lots of bonuses, they're getting all these goodies. But then you look at the one thing that scores at the end of the game, and they haven't really engaged with it in a substantive way.
Too busy having fun.
Yeah, well, no, look, some games lend themselves to that. Some games lend themselves to that because they don't have a sort of scoring system that I don't like, a sort of messy, kind of fudgy, kludgy, point salad-y sort of, well, you're going to get points for everything, so long as you're pulling lots of levers, you're going to do fine.
Yeah.
No, Audubon, it's a focused scoring system, and there comes a time in the game, I'm not saying you have to start focusing on a long-term strategic plan right from the start, but my point is, you can't just play around with the systems and expect to score lots of points the way you can in lots of other Euro games. Anyway. That's actually one of the features that I really like about Audubon. I frequently find that contemporary Euros have too many things going on and the scoring system isn't clean or focused enough. And so I very much appreciate that Audubon gets to have lots of things going on and have a focused scoring system. It's great. Always happy to play Audubon. My only complaint about Audubon is that I wish it were a little shorter.
That's the game we reviewed 1 year ago. Now on to the games we played this week. I want to get this one out of the way because I'm very interested to know what Mark thought about Harmonies. Mark, you got to play Harmonies?
So you didn't even play Harmonies. You're just teeing me up.
Yeah, I am.
Okay.
I'm being nice. I'm like, giving you... No, that's not true. I played several games of Harmony across Board Game Arena, and with the copy that I just got, I played it solo, though. I didn't get to play with multiplayers. A very easy, very similar, like, it's not a solo mode that's going to take you out of the normal game and make you play this weird...
Oh, indeed, because Harmonies is mostly multiplayer solitaire.
Just so.
It's... The incentives for hate drafting are negligible because the problem is you can eyeball somebody else's board and figure out what they want. You can eyeball the animal cards and see what would be good for them. The problem is that the opportunity cost for hate drafting is so high.
Yes.
The terrain tiles especially, those terrain discs, if you take stuff that's not good for you, that's a serious shot in the foot. So... You're going to take the thing that's best for you anyway. No, this is a minor complaint. Harmonies is very, very good. It is very much in the same vein, both in terms of mechanism and gameplay presentation, as things like Cascadia, as any of the other nature-themed drafting and tiling things. But Harmonies is much more to my taste. And primarily it's about the scoring conditions. It's the animals that you're placing out. That I find so fascinating because every animal card, as we've said before, has a pattern of terrain types, both that need to be positioned the right way and layered the right way. And they're going to tell you how and when to get those animals out. And what you need to do is get a terrain system going that can accommodate your animal cards and draft them in such a way that you can most efficiently satisfy as many animals as possible. There are other ways to score, of course. But what I find interesting from a mathematical perspective is all the balancing that has to go on under the hood. Like, for example, bees. Bees want to be surrounded with lots of meadows. But meadows, in a very serious way, in Harmonies, are a bit of a poison pill because nothing can go on top of them. So unlike other types of considerations, like, for example, you want to have a wood pile or a mountain of a certain height. Well, you can do things with those. You can turn wood into a building. You can turn wood into a tree later on. You can make it taller. Same thing with a mountain. You might need it to be level 2 for this fish that you've got, but then you can raise it to level 3 and then stick a mountain lion on it. You have flexibility. But the point values of the animals reflect that. Those are things you do on the way. Bees require sort of an endgame configuration because those meadows are never going to be anything other than meadows. And that interplay is quite interesting to me because it makes the trade-offs less transparent than you might otherwise expect. On top of that, I'm not going to claim that this is particularly thematic or representational, but it's a little evocative in terms of what various animals want. This is a fish that wants to be next to a mountain. These are squirrels that, maybe they're building buildings, maybe they're not, whatever. But they need a vaguely arboreal, but nonetheless, building type setup with wood around. The bees want meadows, etc. And it's cute. It's neat. It felt more evocative than Cascadia did, for example, because Cascadia just wants arbitrary geometric patterns, and they tell you that it corresponds to how elks live. I'm like, okay, fine. You do that. Harmonies was indeed very efficient in terms of its rule set, very visually pleasing, and had a lot of interesting scoring trade-offs, and it was just shy of a spatial nightmare. It's because of all those intersecting efficiencies of placement that it wasn't just about creating spatial patterns on a board. I suspect somebody who had the same kind of scoring tastes that I do and appreciated spatial puzzles might appreciate the game yet more. But I didn't think that it ran afoul of any of my particular proclivities and nonetheless played into some of my preferences. And so, yes, I was very pleased with Harmonies.
Yeah, I love how the fact that, you know, once you've mastered, you know, interlocking all your different animal domains, there's also a end of game scoring on, you know, where your mountains
further
are.
Further trade-offs, yeah.
Further trade-offs of how to make rivers and stuff like that. I think I've narrowed down why I like Harmonies so much. Well, I think it's because when someone says, you know, there's lots of people, Mark, believe it or not. I know you're not going to believe me, but you
just I'm ready. I'm ready. I'm sitting down.
There's some people that don't play as many games as we do.
What?
I know. Weird, I know.
Okay.
So lots of times...
people on the internet tell us we don't know anything about games.
It's true.
So they must be playing so many more than we do.
Yeah, must be true.
Yeah.
People say, you know, well, what's a good board game I should get then? And we always never answer because... but I think Harmonies...
it's fraught.
I think Harmonies is the game.
Have you played Harmonies with non-hobbyist gamers?
Not yet.
Okay.
But I think it seems, I don't know.
I share your intuition. I really do. The problem is I have so much self-doubt about my ability to know what's going to fly and what won't fly. I fear, in particular, that the building restrictions in Harmonies, what things you're allowed to put on top of what other things, like what constitutes a building, how do I make a tree? Why can't I turn this into a building? Why can't, you know?
Maybe.
I worry. Maybe not, but then again, I tend to be surprised. Like, the things that people can grasp, even young children or non-hobbyist gamers or whatever, they often surprise me. It's just intuitively, I wonder if that might be a little tricky.
Could be. With the exploit explanation, maybe I'm just thinking, like, trees and mountains, they can get bigger.
No, they can't. Once it's a tree, it's done.
True. I mean, like, the only thing is going to be multiple levels.
Yes.
Mountains and trees.
And buildings.
Oh, I'm just going to get there. And then okay. You could say, red stacks can be too high. They're buildings, and you can put red wood or stone under that.
Yeah.
It's your choice. Maybe that might make it easier. I don't know. Anyway.
It's possible.
Love Harmonies. Check it out. It's on Board Game Arena. It is designed by...
Johan Benvenuto.
Thank you. I was reading out the artist because I love the art. Art is also amazing in the game.
Oh, yeah.
Maneva
really
Da Silva does the art, and it's published by Liblood.
Played a game called Valka. This is designed by Brooke Penrose, published by Terrible Games. This is a review copy we got from the publisher. I came into Valka with some degree of trepidation and some degree of enthusiasm. The enthusiasm was largely premised on the art. Valka is a multiplayer card battling game where the bulk of the deck consists of units, then there are events, and then there are buffs that you can apply to the various units. And essentially, the default game mode is giving you points for murdering things. And so you go in and you try to murder. Now, multiplayer murderathons are very difficult to do well. There's lots of A and B fights, C wins. There's lots of sniping considerations. There's lots of arbitrariness. And so I was concerned that Valka might run afoul of many of them. One in particular was the prospect of being forced to weaken your opponents so that someone else could swoop in and get the finishing blow. But these concerns were unfounded. Valka is actually very clever in terms of how it structures your attacks. The limitations on who you can attack and when mean that you're never forced to and never incentivized to leave a weakened target so that someone can finish them off. After the initial turns, I was then concerned that maybe there would be some units that would be almost impossible to take down. For example, Huey had a unit with a whole bunch of buffs attached, and so it had a very high defense value and a lot of hit points, and it was just unreasonable to expect that somebody with their four fighters, you can only ever have four fighters on the front line, would be able to take him down. And that's where the nonsense events come in. Now... in a game like Valka, I'm willing to give them a pass. And actually, it kind of serves as, people say this happens all the time, in my experience it seldom does, but in Valka I think it does, a sort of self-balancing mechanism. It's like, oh, you've made that unit too powerful. Well, guess who's going to catch the event that says that they go away? Naturally. So your job is to do as much as you can with as little as you can and be efficient with your attacks to get points that way. In other words, trade-offs and tactical and strategic considerations. And so I was very, very pleased with how Valka shook out in that sense. Valka also has a surprisingly interesting front rank versus back rank distinction. You can do whatever you want on your turn, more or less however you want to your back rank. But once it becomes your front rank, it's set in stone and all you do is attack with them. And your back rank becomes your front rank whenever your front rank gets obliterated, which it will. Don't worry. Everything will die eventually in Valka. And so I was engaged in far more choice making than I thought I would. Now, do the event cards lead to a certain amount of take that complete nonsense? Yes. So you have to expect that in cases where you have this big card to hit something real hard, you're going to sometimes make some arbitrary decisions and some people might get their nose bent out of shape. But frankly, again, then the joyous artwork and the overall theme of arbitrary violence definitely helps to blunt that sensation. So Valka is a very good instantiation of a card game that I normally do not enjoy. Played it with three players. It has a surprisingly robust solo mode that I'm going to be trying sometime over the course of this week. Like, it's got a whole bunch of components, like an entire linen mat that is devoted to the solo mode. So I'm very curious to see how that shakes out. And honestly, it's one of those games, not entirely unlike Hidden Leaders, it's one of those games where every single unit can be worthy of just being passed around to appreciate all the subtle details and the personality that is exuded by the card art. And again, if you're going to do a simple card game like this, it'd best move at a good clip, which Valka does, not lean too hard into the arbitrary nonsense, which Valka kind of sort of does, and have at least some interesting choices, which Valka definitely does. And so I came in with very low expectations to Valka, and I came away very pleased. And so if you're interested in the kind of super beer and pretzels, take that-ish, with a little bit of tactical planning, it's an excellent suggestion along those lines. And I'm looking forward to seeing whether the solo mode has anything interesting in it.
Just made me think of Black Rose Wars and just what a great job they do with that ABC configuration. I think Adrenaline did the same sort of thing.
Yeah, it's an area majority game, yeah.
Where you track.
You track the amount of damage that you do, yeah.
Each player did. So even though someone else does the kill, you get a minor bonus for doing the kill, but
absolutely.
But depending on how much damage people did, there's different stuff that's dealt out.
Yeah, the problem there can get into... It's a common problem with a free-for-all. People have been trying to do the free-for-all well for a very, very long time. You can get into situations where if the scoring system is not robust enough, you bring a meaty target near death, but then no one's incentivized to actually finish it off. And so then you're left in a situation where it's like, well, if you do the first 2 points of damage, you better take it the rest of the way because no one else is going to do anything to it. I think you really need then to, as you say, like Adrenaline did, just reconceptualize the scoring conditions, not even like damage, but just as an area majority contest. And then there is a condition where people will feel like they have some control over their own fate. Valka is operating on a different plane. It's much simpler, much more straightforward. And it's just whoever gets the killing blow. But as I say, nobody is going to weaken a target if they can't finish it off. And it is the case that there are enough tools in your toolkit with some weird random action cards so that you can finish off in one turn for your own score, very beefy units. Valka. I really have to call out Brooke Penrose for the excellent art, both designed by and on the art of Brooke Penrose. Published by Terrible Games in 2024.
So this week I streamed Keep the Heroes Out Boss Battles. So we played Keep the Heroes Out quite often in the before times. It does a sort of turn on your head as the normal dungeon crawling thing. In this case, you're playing the monsters, and it's a cooperative game, and then the heroes do this sort of set computer-like program. If they enter, they activate other heroes, and then they attack people, and then they try to open chests, and then you try to get them to an exhausted state so they stop moving through your dungeon and not get to the center part, in which you lose. This just makes it that much harder. They added some cards. They're called rookie cards, where, you know, just weaker heroes. So you can put a number of those in the deck if you wish, but it just makes the deck larger, and the whole purpose of the game is to get through this deck twice.
You got to save those rookie cards, though. If they make it big, then they're going to be worth a lot later on.
So true. So in this, you have to go through the deck twice. So there's sort of more scenario-like, so I'm not sure if everyone's going to play it this way, but it seems as though once you make it through the decks once, then the main monster is going to appear, and he rampages through your dungeon with the heroes.
Why?
I'm not sure. Well, in this case, minor spoilers, you are building a rock troll, and then because you didn't build him quite right, he's a little crazy, and he goes rampaging through.
So long as they give some sort of explanation.
So they also activate heroes. They have their own deck that you turn up, and they like throw heroes down the hallway. They do all sorts of weird things. And they have like 15 hit points. So at the beginning of the scenario, it's this sort of loosey-goosey legacy type thing, because some of the decks are hidden and you're not sure, so they give you like hints. You're going to be fighting something that has 15 hit points. Take monsters accordingly, like ones that are going to do big damage.
Dargon.
So very last turn, we got lucky. It was right down to, I play this card, Sidewinder. I play this last card, lets me draw a card. If I don't draw a card that has an attack, that will bring him from 14 to 15 hit points. We lose. Lucky enough, we did it. And that will unlock, now, minor spoilers, of course, like I said, it's kind of loosey-goosey. You know, everything's in the book. You can read, you know, I mean, it's just weird how they laid it out. But anyway.
Isn't loosey-goosey a boss that would be able to destroy maybe all the monsters right away? Have you seen geese? You don't mess with geese.
Canadian geese? No.
Yeah.
So now,
cobra chickens is what they are.
Now, in future games, we can play the Rock Troll as a character. So now he has his own deck that we opened up. And all of the new scenarios are like that. They're going to be something new, and it's going to unlock new monsters that you can play. And the plethora of monsters is already huge. Slimes and skeletons and kobolds. And anyway, I love everything about Keep the Heroes Out. I love the fact that it scales so well with different player counts. You can just go right down to one player, and it doesn't change the rules whatsoever.
How adorable is the Rock Troll? Because the meeples in Keep the Heroes Out are truly some of the best I've ever seen.
It is just as adorable as the rest.
That's great. He's
very hilarious.
Yeah, I look forward to trying this. Not so much for the structure. The change of the structure, I'm not sure I'd be down with, because the one thing that I can never internalize in Keep the Heroes Out, I've played a bunch of times, is how the heroes operate. If I were ever playing solo once, I'd probably be able to internalize it. But when they move, when they open a chest, when they do other things, their targeting priorities, it's very simple. I haven't grokked it fully.
Yeah, they show up. They all show off. They all, like, the archer shoots, the thief disarms traps, the warrior destroys any random equipment you might have left there. Then if there's a trap there, they'll get killed. Then they will attack something if it's there. If there's nothing to attack, they'll try to open a chest. And all the chests have a number on them. They need that many heroes there to open the chest. If not, they're just exhausted. And if they attack and kill something, they're exhausted. So like I said, you're just trying to get them to that exhausted state. So they don't, because if there's nothing there, no chests and no one to attack, then they advance to the next room towards your treasure chamber. And if there's any exhausted heroes there, now they're all activated. And then, yeah.
Yeah, see, that's the part, right? It's the cascade that them showing up and that part I get, but the cascade, that's where I start to lose the thread.
And the other great thing about Keep the Heroes, it's all done by the same person, Louis Bra. He does all the art. He is also the designer of the game. It's all come out through crowdfunding. If you have a chance to play it, I'd definitely give it a try. Great cooperative game. Keep the Heroes Out.
We got to play Undaunted 2200 Callisto. This is, unsurprisingly, by Trevor Benjamin and David Thompson.
Now, I do want to say this is a review copy.
No, it's not.
Because we were told.
No.
But I had to buy this copy because, yeah. All right, we'll stop there.
No, it's not. See, Walker is operating under the delusion that anybody from Osprey listens to this podcast. We do indeed have a review copy coming, but Walker's insatiable enthusiasm meant that when he saw that there was retail available in Canada, he jumped on it like some sort of stereotype involving someone jumping on something.
These are true.
True facts.
All right, so I got to do the bit's good, so I got to do it again. So there's a solo mode. But the solo book is 65 pages long, Mark. It was very daunting. So I fixed that, Mark.
How did you fix it?
I fixed that by reading through it and understanding and made it undaunted. See what I did there? It's undaunted now.
I'm amazed that you have not produced from on your phone a rimshot generating app. Sounds like the kind of thing that would be appropriate. So Undaunted is the now somewhat long-running series of two-player deck-building tactical fighty games. It started with Undaunted Normandy and has moved to various theaters in World War II, even being adapted to air combat in Undaunted Battle of Britain in a substantial departure. And now we have sci-fi with Undaunted 2200 Callisto. And I have to say that this is less of a departure than Battle of Britain was, certainly. But it is nonetheless somewhat of a departure. It involves some of the vehicle rules from North Africa and Undaunted reinforcements. And it definitely has more player asymmetry than a lot of the other Undaunted ones have. Like, for example, in the first scenario, you typically have in an Undaunted game some rifles and some scouts, and they have the same stats, and you have the same cards, and the differentiation comes from possibly some positioning, and of course then the player decisions in terms of what cards they buy and in what order, and how they choose to activate things. The first scenario for Undaunted 2200, I was very surprised to see, not only is it the case that one side has a couple of mechs and the other side doesn't, but the core troops have significant asymmetries as well. They have, you know, the equivalent of riflemen in the Core Undaunted series. Both sides have those. Corpsec in one case and Rippers in the other. I don't know why they're called Rippers. I'm sure there's some industrial reason. But then all the other units have very different stats and abilities. And I was very, very surprised, given my experience with past Undaunted products.
True, and it feels as though they're trying to change it up a bit. There's only one play in, but it seems as though in Undaunted, it seems very sort of hold ground, objective-based. You know, you go up, you control areas, shooting happens, but it's not terribly, not so much tons of death.
It's a means to an end. It's
means not to an end. In the game we played, there was a lot of death.
It was a meat grinder.
A lot of shooting.
Absolutely.
Guns seem to roll a lot more dice.
Oh, yes.
And yes, a lot more stuff happens.
It has again, in other Undaunted scenarios, you tend to get to machine gunners that get to roll multiple dice in scenario 3, 4, 5, maybe even. This, in the first scenario, we had, as I said, one side has a mech, the other side has heavy gunners, and it's in a smaller, tighter space. So yes, there was a lot of shooting.
And it does this very interesting thing with height. So if you take the high ground. Jedis have shown us, Mark, that high ground matters.
Could we keep the Star Wars to a minimum here?
Nope. So in normal Undaunted series, you're always rolling D10s. Now you can roll D12s and maybe even D8s. If you're lower shooting up, then you're D8s. If you're higher shooting down, you're rolling D12s. Easier to hit or harder to hit. Very much nice and simple. Game still flowed.
Now, I do appreciate the fact that there is a greater volume of dice being thrown. One of my complaints about previous Undaunted games. I love the series. I'm absolutely in love with all the Undaunted games. But insofar as I have complaints, it's probably that there's a small volume of dice being rolled and some of the consequences for an individual attack can be huge. So I completely respect the fact that in Undaunted 2200, at least so far, there just seems to be a higher volume. So the results tend to even out. But consequently, there's just a lot more casualties, which is an interesting departure. It took a while for me to wrap my head around, and it's one of the reasons why I stalled in the early bits of our play, because I was playing it like Undaunted Normandy rather than Undaunted 2200. So shame on me for not adapting to changing circumstances. Another interesting change is that, and this is more of a component change, it's no longer the case that you get a bunch of tiles and you build the map before play. Every scenario has its own dedicated folding board, which is a little wild, frankly. It's a radical departure. The victory conditions are printed right on the board. You don't have to set up any tiles. It allows for some weird geometry. No longer is it the case that it's just a whole bunch of squares set up in a grid so as to replicate a hex. If you arrange squares properly, they can simulate the Bestigons. They will never be the Bestigons, but they can get close to being the Bestigons if you arrange them properly. I don't know how I feel about that change. I'm going to hold judgment until I see other scenarios, because again, some of the times when the Undaunted series has been at its best has been in clever scenario design, and some of the times when it's been at its weakest has been the scenarios that appealed to me less intensely. But I love the graphics. It's got a sort of darkish sci-fi tone. Some of the gear is vaguely reminiscent of Infinity and that kind of aesthetic, which I very much appreciate. And I have yet to have a bad experience with Undaunted. It is an amazing system, and I love watching it iterate. And Undaunted 2200 is probably, other than Battle of Britain, the most different from the other ones thus far.
It's got a great theme, right? It's, you know, the common man versus the corporation, right? So the corporation wants to settle
the common worker, let's say.
Yeah, the common worker. So the corporation wants to colonize some moons, so they send the people in, and they're mining ice so they can, you know, feed all of these people water and such. But unfortunately, the miners mine the ice, the corporation takes the ice, and then they sell it back to the miners at inflated prices. And, you know, guess what? The miners get a little upset about that. I don't know why. And that is the background of Undaunted 2200 Callisto.
Solidarity, Walker.
Solidarity.
Yeah, more to follow. I'm keen to see the other scenarios and see yet more of the units, because there are units we haven't played around with. And given that the unit differentiation is much, much higher in this version. I'm very curious.
And there's a very, very good chance that I'm going to show up on stream on mornings doing the solo parts of it. So
I'm curious about the solo mode. Solo mode of Undaunted Reinforcements, which was an expansion to both North Africa and Normandy, consolidated them into one huge box and gave a solo mode. It was David Tsirtse at his most David Tsirtse-est. Now, because of my enthusiasm for Undaunted, and because on occasion I am willing to suffer through a David Tsirtse solo mode, I was keen to give it a try. The problem was it was burdened with so many typos and so many errata on publication. I just set it aside and set it out of mind at the time. Now, there have been replacements issued, and so now I have all the properly printed scenarios, and so I'm keen to revisit that. But my understanding is that this solo system is yet again different, and so it would be interesting to see the two different systems and how they work. Undaunted 2200 Callisto.
We got to get back to Starfarers of Catan Duel. This is designed by Klaus Tuber and Benjamin Tuber and put out by Catan Studio. And it is a two-player only Catan-esque science fiction game where you're modifying your ship and you're sort of diving into these planets that are represented by a 9-card deck.
Systems, yeah.
And so you have your engines that are going to tell you how many cards you're going to be able to draw. And then there's modules on your ship that will tell you how many actions you can take while you're going through those cards. And you're just making your tableau better, collecting resources, and trying to get the most victory conditions before the other player.
It's just the right amount of memory for me. You get a certain vibe of a system. It's like, oh yeah, that's the system you go to sell trade goods and buy cheap rocks. Or, oh, that's the system that has all the victory condition planets that have all the missions that attached to them. Past that, I don't tend to memorize too deeply, especially since in part they change as systems are colonized or trade posts are established. New cards enter the system, and so there's always a certain amount of mystery. And on top of that, there's a certain element of press your luck, because even if all you're doing is buying and selling goods, you have to try to figure out, it's like, well, I have 3 more cards left to go in that deck. I would like to buy this red, but really I'm here for cheap blue. So do I take the risk? Am I going to run into that planet? I very much appreciate that.
The game we played this time was a little bit different than our first game because there was definitely a system that was sort of like the payout system.
Yes.
So you'd go to the payout system, you'd generate your goods and or money, and then you would venture out into the more difficult systems.
Absolutely. One of the things I really appreciate about Starfarer's Duel, and this has been true ever since it was published decades ago, is I think it's quite a good length for a two-player non-filler. It's about 60 to 75 minutes, which is long enough so that you can feel a sense of development, a sense of investment in your advanced technological modules for them to pay off later, a sense of an ebb and flow. Sometimes you're rich, you can get poor, but have enough time to dig yourself out of that poverty again. But not so long that it starts to get too repetitive, again, because you're mostly just diving into these same 4 systems again. And yeah, the decks change, but not a huge amount. I do wish that it had a little bit more of an arc. You know, what you're doing in round 1 is more or less what you're going to be doing in the last round. But again, I think that would be only more of a problem if the game were longer than it was.
I love how they sort of handle the flow, because even though it's one player's turn, the other player is handling the system decks. And they can sort of push the game along. It's like, okay, you're going to get 6 cards, you get to do 3 actions, and then boom, 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 they start putting, you know, make your choice, make your choice, make your choice. And then it's back to the other player's turn, and the other player does the same thing. They roll the dice, grab your system, and push you through it. And it goes fast.
You're right. I hadn't thought of it in those terms. It's one of the reasons why it seems to move at such a better clip than the standard card game version of Catan, where, again, you'd have these more in-depth actions, but the other player just sits and waits. There, the token sop is, well, the die roll can generate resources for both players, but that's not really a thing to do. It's like, yeah, I tick up one of my resources by one. That's not a huge deal. But yeah, the other player gets to manage the deck, and so they feel more involved in what's going on in the turn. It also gives them an opportunity to engage with the system in a tactile way, which can help them remember what is in that system for when their turn rolls around, either immediately or thereafter. Catan Starfarer's Duel. Really glad you enjoyed it. As I say, I've liked it ever since it first got published. And I think that the two-player Catan card games are super interesting in how they change in the formula, because I don't have much enthusiasm for Settlers of Catan or Cities and Knights. But all the spin-off stuff, the historical variants, they're not all good, but they're usually interesting. And I really like the two-player card game variants. So that's my level of Catan enthusiasm. Got to play Rise and Fall. This is a recent delivery from crowdfunding. Walker backed it on Kickstarter. This is by Christophe Bélanger, who's a reliably interesting game designer. He's done Dungeon Twister. He's done Archipelago. He's done Earth Reborn. Very different things. All very interesting. This was published by Ludicali, which is more or less the publishing house of Christophe Bélanger. And first off, the components are drop-dead gorgeous. This is, you know, a justification of crowdfunding. It doesn't really look a whole heck of a lot like other games. It's got simultaneously multi-level chunky tiles to set up the terrain, and these beautiful, they're not screen printed, but they're kind of sticker laminated meeples of all different kinds, and each of the pieces is full of character. Like, you have these people whose job it is to go get stone from a mountain. So let's have a wooden guy riding a wooden white tiger. It's like, okay.
What? How else would you do that?
You do you. Like, might as well have that flight of fancy. It is a no-luck, deterministic, kind of sort of expand your pieces out vaguely within striking distance of abstract thing where you're scoring points for having pieces out on the board and you're scoring points for having area majorities of various groupings of terrain tiles that exist after you've built it. On top of that, you're getting points for money. And yeah.
I think in this particular game, much like...
It was weird.
Much like our Catan game, where the one deck was like the sort of payout, you build this map completely from scratch every time you play the game. And the way that the map sort of panned out in our game, there was a giant lake, river, ocean, whatever you want to call it.
It was a lake. It was a straight line.
That ran right through the middle. Therefore, when people were building cities, they tended to be on the coast. And then there was a ship action that gave you money for every city that was on the coast. And so the ship action became super powerful for generating money. And I don't think it's going to... I might be wrong. For this particular game, it just seemed like a super money-generating system.
Keep in mind, it's not like this happened by accident. There wasn't some sort of exogenous pressure that caused us to establish cities on the coast. This is a deliberate strategy by the individual who had boats to build more cities on the coast. And because it's a no-luck, not perfect, it's almost perfect information, but because it's an entirely deterministic game that happens on a very sort of staid pace, you put out nomads, the nomads help you get more cities, the cities help you get more nomads, et cetera, and then you change the nomads into various things and build other buildings. An early advantage can and will snowball. I found the scoring conditions difficult to internalize. Again, unlike Audubon, where you can keep your eyes on the prize even though there's a lot of stuff going on, I felt certainly on a first play that the balancing the different pressures was not remotely intuitive to me. And so consequently, it was a little unsatisfying because an early advantage just snowballed and continued because money is so profitable. You get 1 point for every $2. And the last tax action that the winner of the game did brought in $90 redos. That's a lot of points, even in a high scoring a game like Rise and Fall. The key, the hook, as Walker would say, the conceit that drew me in, I shouldn't say the hook, a hook that appealed to me, was the aforementioned Rise and Fall. As things get scored, you are obliged to obsolete one of your cards, and so a type of unit you have on the board will no longer activate. However, this didn't really shake out in a way that I found very interesting for two reasons. Number one, it doesn't happen very much. And number two, you can spend money to get it back. And I just identified that money is worth a lot of points, but the first time you spend money to get it back, it only costs you 5. That's just a couple points. It's not a big deal. Second time you do it, it costs you 10. Also not a big deal. And so that's already 2 of the 4 retirements that you might have. And the last retirement happens at the very end of the game anyway. And so I didn't get this sense of an ebb and flow of your card flow. It was just this efficiency puzzle of churning out maximal board influence as quickly as possible, where board influence is attenuated and differentiated based on different kinds of scoring conditions. And so consequently, it's an interesting system that I might want to try again, but it didn't really grab me on a first play.
Yeah, I'm wondering with future plays, it'll be more Barony-like, like I said earlier before I played it and just read the book, where which happened a little bit in our game. There was definitely blocking because only one piece can be per space with very few exceptions. And so you're blocking off parts of the map. You're stopping people from putting out units because you suddenly move around their city. And like I said at the beginning, you do build the map. So I'm wondering if we will, to fix this problem, A, not make, you know, rivers that go through it the whole map and or that big, and B, we'll not build as many cities on said larger water masses.
So you call it a problem. I'm not sure that it is. What we're doing is identifying the thing that the person identified early in the game and exploited repeatedly in a no-luck deterministic system. Whether it's that exploit or some other exploit, I'm indifferent. I mean, if somebody finds a different exploit that they pump repeatedly and cruise to victory, and it's pretty clear they're going to win early on in the game, and we still play the remaining 4/5 of the game just to find out the inevitable, I'm indifferent. I don't care whether it's that or something else. My point is that in no-luck games like this, there often have to be, there has to be something going on, not even necessarily random, so as to disrupt an early advantage that then just compounds. And an early mistake, a slight trip up in terms of efficiency. Like, for example, largely, this is something that I don't tend to do very often, but I do on occasion. I decided to build a new unit because I wanted to see a new unit play around. That was a mistake. It cost me valuable tempo. It meant I couldn't cycle my units at the same rate. It slowed down the rate at which I was gaining new units. It slowed down the rate at which I was getting new cities, which is the way you pump out new units, and I never recovered. And that, again, that was a mistake I made very early on in the game. I'm not going to claim that the rest of my play was perfect, but this is what you can expect from no-luck deterministic systems. And generally speaking, I look for a little more variation or a shorter game in such instances.
Well, I felt the flow was very good, because what you're doing is you've got your hand of cards, which is a card for every unit you have. Everyone picks one and puts it down secretly, and then you flip up, and then you go through and you do the actions. So I feel the flow was not terrible. It got a little cumbersome near the end, because every unit of that particular type gets to do something. But I think it still, in the end, went pretty quickly.
I'm not saying it was long. I was saying it was probably longer than it needed to be.
Yes. No, that wasn't a counter. It was just...
Don't undermine me in front of the children, Walker.
I'm sorry. And that is Rise and Fall. Next up, I got Louis to bring Martian Dice. Martian Dice is one of Scott Elm's very early designs, and it is the one design that I wish to have. Take that as you will. This is published by the now defunct Tasty Minstrel Games, and it's just a straight-up dice game that I play a lot on Board Game Arena because it's something I can have going on the side. And you're just rolling the dice, and it's like a push-your-luck sort of element. Every time you roll tanks, you bring them out, and then you're trying to get humans, cows, and chickens, and you can only choose them once. Every time you roll the dice, you have to choose something. So either you're choosing flying saucers to counteract the tanks, or you're trying to get your scoring opportunity. And once you're done rolling the dice, you have to have as many saucers as you have tanks, and then you score 1 point for every cow, chicken, or human you have, and if you happen to have at least one of each, you get a bonus 5 points. So this is interesting sort of dice play. Showed it to Butterfly. She liked it. She was like, oh, where can we get this? It's like, no problem. We just won't give it back to Louis. We'll just keep it. So I'm looking forward to playing more of that in real life. I haven't played it in real life for quite a while because it's very hard to get. Very much enjoy Martian Dice by Scott Elms and Tasty Minstrel Games. Those are the games we played this week. Now, on to the news and why it doesn't matter.
But first, a brief break to pay some bills.
Make the right call for the right Medicare Advantage benefits. Go to MedMutual.com/review to schedule your free Medicare plan review with Medical Mutual, Ohio's hometown Medicare insurer.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
And we're back. And now on to the news and why it doesn't matter. Walker and I are members of the jury for the International Gamers Awards. Winners of 2024 have been announced, and once again, I have to say, I am very, very pleased with the results. Not everything went down exactly as I would have voted, but I'm overall pleased to be part of such an excellent slate. So the International Gamers Award for the Best Multiplayer Experience is Nucleum by Simone Luciani and David Tirtze, published by Board and Dice. We're fans of Nucleum. It is an interesting kind of riff on Barrage. For the best two-player experience is Sky Team by Luc Ramon and published by Scorpion Masqué. Another plaudit for Sky Team, well-deserved. And for solo experience, it's Imperium Horizons, designed by David Tirtze and Nigel Buckle, by Osprey. I am a massive fan of the Imperium system, and I do agree that as far as solo goes, it is probably David Tirtze's best work. And so I'm very, very pleased that those are the ones that won. It was an honor to be included in the process once again, and congratulations to all that won.
My one piece of news is another wooden German game, like Hamster Roll, because it's not a giant circle.
That's racist. Germans aren't made out of wood.
But it's...
I'm 90% sure they're made out of the same things we are.
It's a little bit like tumbling dice. So it's hard.
Maybe 85.
It's hard to explain this, Mark. Think of a spiral staircase.
Uh-huh.
But very, low incremental, and it never comes back on itself. So it's sort of just like an arching staircase. And then you have these meeples, which are these large, tall cones that have giant cylindrical hats around the brim. So, and there's no rules yet. I can only surmise. Well, they announced it. All of the rules I found were in German. So
there's
I can't really tell you from the description.
All right. So there's the staircase and then there are these hats. No rules yet, but.
There's a description. Meeples with hats, Mark. Come on now. Keep up. And so you're advancing up this staircase, collecting dragon eggs.
Are you trying to get us kicked off the IGA? I realize that any given 5 minutes of our...
Does it matter? And it looks as though you're going to be able to push these guys. There's sorcerers going up these stairs. There can only be two sorcerers per stair now, of course. And you're picking up these dragon eggs as you go up. And there's going to be a mechanic that I'm sure will push these off. And you're trying to knock the other guys off the staircase. It looks very interesting. Check it out. It's... translated into Dragon Stairs. Looks like it's going to be a great game from the description. Mark, this giant wooden thing.
Yeah.
Stop giving me a hard time.
Finally for me, more David Thompson and Trevor Benjamin news. There's going to be another game already announced, well, kind of leaked.
Super secret.
Well, it's on the internet.
It is.
It's on Big River.
We can pretend that we got fancy news.
No, it's not fancy news. Right. It's on Amazon. It's not fancy when it's on Amazon. I'm sorry. Called Line of Fire Burnt Moon. So this details are scant at the moment. It's going to be having some of the deck building elements of the Undaunted series with some lean battling going on. Another two-player game. I am a huge fan of the output of David Thompson. I'm a huge fan of the output of Trevor Benjamin. I'm a huge fan of the output of David Thompson and Trevor Benjamin. So color me triply excited about Line of Fire Burnt Moon. It's not going to be coming out for a while yet. It has a posted release date of 2025 because, again, it hasn't really been announced yet. But Big River says they should have it next year, so we'll see when and if that happens.
Gives me like a Convoy vibe. Remember from Niroshima Hex? They had that whole world of Niroshima Hex, and it's like, oh, here's a side card game where you like battle each other out. So yeah, it gave me that vibe when I heard about it.
That is the news and why it doesn't matter. Now onto our topic of the week, which is replayability.
Now, I think we should talk about this quickly, Mark. Because
it's the topic of the week. When
when I was
Do you know how this works?
Looking,
we talk about things on the
It's true, but
yeah.
But I want to be clear exactly what we are talking about.
You got it.
Because when I was researching it, they seemed to get things mixed up about what I think this should be about.
Sure.
This is not, is it a good design? Was it fun? So we're going to play it again.
Right.
This is elements and mechanisms and things about the game that will make it different enough that you want to play it multiple times.
Well, whether or not you want to play it multiple times, right?
Yeah,
the game could
have
excellent replayability, but it'd be garbage.
It's
yes,
true.
Yes. What actually occurred to me while thinking about it was actually in the context of something we were discussing not too long ago, and that is game mastery. Typically, I agree with you. That's my understanding of replayability, the way you articulated it. But there can be, for some people, a kind of cross purposes, because people who really enjoy developing game mastery, some of them prefer games that actually don't have a certain kind of flexibility or variability in the game state, because they want to do, and no judgment, this is not how I like to do games, but there's some people who like to do games, particularly Euros, the same way each time. And they just want to shave a couple seconds off their time, effectively, in the equivalent. And so for them, replayability, and what they want out of replayability, which is to say certainty, and what I want out of replayability, which is to say variability, not necessarily randomness, but
new experiences, I have that up here, yeah.
Those can be at cross purposes. But anyway, we're not really going to be talking too much about that kind of game mastery practice replayability kind of thing, more this other model. But just the fact that there's another paradigm at cross purposes I found interesting.
Which was odd, because it came up a lot. For whatever reason, when I was researching, the chess was thrown in there so often. I don't know why, but that leads into exactly right. What you were just talking about.
Yeah, it doesn't. But when I say variability, it doesn't have to be randomness.
That's
right.
Right.
And even just in terms of stock chess openings, there are far too many than any given human can be expected to internalize. Yeah, I was thinking, and this is actually one of those kinds of games that tend to lead themselves to replayability very, very, very well. A lot of modern hobbyist gamers assume that replayability has to be tied to either variable setup and or variable player powers, but positional abstracts have a level of replayability that most hobby games can and never will touch.
This is what I have as the first category. You can disagree or agree. I have a push and pull interaction. Like player interaction leads to.
What do you mean by push and pull? Is that?
Well, I mean, like, you know, you have reaction to other person. This person pushes in this area, and so you want to replay it because there's like this interaction between the players that will change the game up every time you play it.
Yeah, and that to me, we're kind of starting at the top, and for my preferences, we're going to be working our way down. That to me is the apex
of
replayability. That is the best kind of replayability, and that's one of the reasons why these fixed opening games tend to have such a high degree of replayability. The one sort of like classic positional abstract that I find the most interesting is actually Shogi. I never got any good, but I find the system interesting, and it is one of those abstracts that is very, very, very hard to program for an AI, precisely because by a mid-game state, the possible states are so huge because of the number of pieces you could bring back. Anyway, I'm sure someone will be like, well, you know, Go is so much better. I know. Go will always reign supreme in this area. But in terms of hobbyist games, this is one of the reasons why I love Tigers and Euphrates so much. It doesn't feel like a positional abstract, but it has that level of variability. People all the time, when I'm explaining Tigers and Euphrates, like, well, you know, what's a typical score look like? I can't tell you. I've seen winning scores of 4. I've seen winning scores of, like, high teens. It can be all over the place. How many monuments go out? Where are they built? How are they contested? Who builds them? What color are they going to be?
How early in the game they're built.
Precisely. A million separate factors, and all of them are a function of player agency with a minor influence from the tiles they drew. There is absolutely randomness in Tigers and Euphrates, yes, absolutely. And yes, there are stock openings, and the number of stock openings in Tigers and Euphrates are dwarfed by the number of openings in any positional abstract of any quality. But Tigers and Euphrates is my favorite game in part because of the endless replayability I think it has.
So another game which I feel has high playability by the same designer, Reiner Knizia, but has no variability, no randomness. We have Stevenson's Rocket.
Yes.
Right? And it's just all about that push and pull that I was talking about. You know, how and when to manipulate the stock market, how to build the tracks, when to, you know, cross off other tracks. Anyway.
Allow me to push back a little bit, because I definitely think that Stevenson's Rocket has a lot more replayability than most other things in the hobbyist market. I would say the same thing about Through the Desert, but I think that both Through the Desert and Stevenson's Rocket pale in comparison to Tigers and Euphrates, because most of the time, you're going to end up doing the same things in the same way, just sometimes in slightly different orders and with slightly different colors, right? At the end of a game of Stevenson's Rocket, I don't know what railroad is going to end up being the one that destroys everybody and swallows up all those other railroads. But odds are excellent. It's almost guaranteed there's going to be a railroad that's going to go do it, right? You don't know who is going to have the longest caravan of various camel colors, and you don't know whether it's going to be by margin of one or a margin of five, but if you want to do well in through the desert, you're going to have to be meddling in all those things. You're going to need to go and get some oases. You're going to have to be competitive in some of the longest, you know, things like that. I don't feel like you're... Even though you have to get all four colors of points in Tigris and Euphrates, the way you go about doing it, how many conflicts you're going to participate in, again, everything related to monuments, how many treasures you're going to go for, what tactics you're going to employ to take them, things like that, whether or not you use any of your disasters, you can end with both of them. Anyway, all of those things, I think, mean that Tigris and Euphrates is a step above those other ones, even though there's a level of replayability. Because, as I say, you're going to end up more or less in the same kind of place, even though the details will differ.
So the next category I have is many paths to victory. So like all different sort of tracks you can go up and sort of, you know, and, you know, play different games where you go, oh, I'm going to go up this track, or I'm going to go up that track. And that just leads into sort of another sort of discussion, is making the game just hard enough to work those levers. Because there are a few games where... I don't want to say handcuff you, because that's a negative thing, but don't make the game hard enough and you end up at the end of the game on the top of all of the tracks.
Right. You're not forced to make trade-offs. It's just a question of what order you do things in.
Exactly. And therefore, and the game will play out the same almost every time, because you get to the end of all the tracks by the end. Whereas some games where you just have to give up on some tracks, like we talked about Audubon, there's some tracks that you just don't go up. And other games that I have here, like Hansa Teutonica, you know, there's all the...
Absolutely.
Other tracks that, you know, it's like, well, that's just too contested. I'm going to try this other strategy this time.
Well, you put it in terms of tracks. Most games involving different colored tracks that focus on different kinds of strategies. This is a Mark problem, not a problem with design. I find myself tending to play them the same way each time. You know, they give me the option of focusing on any number of different things. But if there's no good pressure from other players, or possibly from some sort of randomized supply, I'm going to follow the same instincts that I probably did before. I don't have your experimental disposition. And that I respect your experimental disposition. It's like, well, last time I went up the purple track, now I want to go up the red track. I don't tend to think that way. It's like, oh, it worked for me before, I'm going to do it again. And that's one of the reasons why I think that Audubon and games like Hansa Teutonica, I do those things. I go up different tracks, I focus on different things in response to player pressure. If everyone's dive bombing the Sack City in Hansa, I'm going to leave that alone and seek my efficiencies elsewhere, even though I really like leveling up my Sack track. And that again, I think, is an instance of the fact that the very best player interaction will lead to the best kind of replayability, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, games like Agricola, in this case, where the game makes it more difficult because those worker placement spots are so contested that you're going to have to change your strategy on a dime. If you know these places that are taken, you're going to have to figure out a different way to get your victory points.
I don't know. Agricola, for me, might be one of those games where you're going to end up more or less in the same space regardless. I feel it's just a question of which efficiencies you're going to get when. That's because of the scoring system. In Agricola, the scoring system will penalize you for not having anything of a particular type. So you're going to end up with a farm with at least a little bit of everything a lot of some other things.
But how you get there.
But how you get there is different. But again, I'm talking about, I absolutely appreciate it. Agricola, for me, has a lot of replayability. But if you compare it to Tigris and Euphrates, when you compare it to things like Hansa Teutonica, where the player pressure almost by itself produces radically different board states, I don't think that Agricola compares. When I play Agricola, if I have some professions or some improvements that make me more efficient at planting, what that means is I'm just going to have to work harder at building up my farmhouse and building stables and building fences and things like that. But I need to build those things. I'm just going to do that other thing easier. Conversely, the variability that might encounter is either by virtue of player placement pressure or by virtue of the toys that I've been dealt. Maybe it's just flipped and one thing's easier and the other thing's harder. I'm going to do both. There is a certain amount of replayability, absolutely, I'll happily replay them. I have been over the course of the years, but I don't think it's at that same level.
Games that handcuff you, like Gaia Project, like I talked about, where there's so much you want to do, but you're always so limited by the resources you have. So, you know, it's going to change every game that you're going to play.
Or does this just mean you're just going to rely more on your player faction? Because that's just it. A number of people have observed this. Chris Farrell, Matt Thrower, a bunch of I'm leaving out a whole bunch of journalists, but and game reviewers, but people tend to assume that replayability comes from variable player powers. Sometimes I think that's true. I think of games like Root. Root feels very different based on what faction you're playing. Agricola, less so. Again, I'm going to be doing the same things, just with different efficiencies. Ankh has tons of variable player powers. I love Ankh. I adore it. I don't think it has that same level of variability, of replayability. Voyages of Marco Polo, even Cosmic Encounter, right? I'm going to be doing all the same things, mostly in the same way, just some things are going to be easier. Like a classic example in Cosmic Encounter is, you know, one of the player powers might be the loser. They, on Encounter, they normally lose, they win. In Encounter, they normally win, they lose. That's really cool, shakes things up, leads to lots of interesting things. But at the end of the day, you still need to win encounters.
Yes.
It just changes the parameters about how you do it. And yeah, that's a kind of replayability. But I don't think it's at that same level. When I play a game like Gaia Project, when I play a game like Terra Mystica, I really feel like by virtue of the tight economy, which I appreciate, I'm just going to be leaning more into the asymmetry given to me by my faction. And again, there's some replayability there, but not at that same level.
True. It means you're doing the, I meant, you're still doing the same sort of things you're going to do anyway, but you're never going to get to do everything you want to do, regardless of your player power.
That's true.
The game limits you so much, right, that you're never going to max out everything.
Yeah, for me, that's a question of prioritization and trade-offs, and I love those things in game designs. But again, that goes back to my own personal preferences. If you put me in a situation of scarcity, I'm probably just going to make the same prioritizations game after game, unless other player actions or the supply itself provided by the game force me to react differently.
When you talked about Root, it made me think of something interesting, because there are a lot of games that have asymmetric powers. But what Root does differently, I think, is when the asymmetric powers butt against each other and the combination of them.
That's true.
Where other games are just like, okay, well, I do something different and I do something different.
Yeah.
Well, and they never really interact with each other, but
it's true.
Whereas Root, it's a whole combination of what everybody does and how they're going to interact.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, like I started to think of like some of my favorite games that have very strong asymmetric powers, but I don't think they reach that same level of replayability. And the three that I came up with were, I already mentioned, Ankh, Voyages of Marco Polo, Cosmic Encounter. Love those games. They're great. I'll play them anytime. But I don't think that they really leverage that same kind of magic replayability that games like Hanzo Teutonica, games like Chess or Shogi or Go or Tigers and Euphrates have, precisely because you don't have that level that Root does of truly changing the game state by virtue of the different powers interacting with each other.
I have the next category. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. It's called Send In More Cards.
Yes, absolutely.
So we have
which again Agricola does too.
Yes, more cards for Agricola. I have them. I have Terraforming Mars.
Yep.
Giant deck. Orleans has so many different buildings. You know, so like every game, if you can build different buildings.
But again, I don't think there's much payoff there in terms of there's a level of replayability. It's like, oh, I see this card that I haven't seen before. But if it's just generating a plant tag, or if it's just generating an efficiency somewhere else, I mean, I'm not complaining. Again, second tier. That's all.
Mage Knight. So many cards. Different combinations every time.
It's true.
Race for the Galaxy.
Yeah. Race for the Galaxy and Blood Rage are a couple of games that I think are games where you're going to end up with a different set of abilities, largely by virtue of a response to scarcity. But they're not quite at that. Again, I'm feeling like a bit of a broken record. I'm not quite at that same level, because you're going to be forced by virtue of the draw deck or the draft to make some optimizations based on what's available to you. And so, yeah, your tableau is going to look very different from game to game. And you might end up doing different things. You know, one game of Blood Rage, even if you have very fixed preferences, you might be in a position where you're winning all your fights because that's how you get points. And in a different game, you might be losing all your fights because that's how you get points. And it ends up feeling very different. And that's as a consequence of the draft. Similarly, Race for the Galaxy, you might be pursuing a military strategy or a consume strategy or a development strategy, whatever, it partially as a result of the cards that you're presented to. And so there, I think that's slightly better than the kind of variability you're going to encounter in things like Gaia Project or Agricola, because you are genuinely forced to specialize.
Next category. It's called Tell Me a Story. So this is like games that have campaigns or missions or scenarios. And so you pick a different scenario and it's going to drastically change the game state.
Okay. Can you think of games where, because I was thinking about this too, some of my favorite scenario-driven games, Combat Commander, Command and Colors, Gloomhaven. I like the fact that there are different scenarios. Seldom, though, we address this. It can be a trap. We address this in the context of Fateforge. Either the scenario completely changes things, in which case you might object because it's messing with the fundamental system, or it's just a slightly different reconfiguration of stuff you've been doing all the time before. And I feel like in the context of most of the time, scenario-driven games do that latter category.
Well, I do have a couple. Like Spirit Island, right? When you choose the difficulty and stuff, so that's sort of like a scenario that drastically changes the game, and I think it's in a
okay.
good way.
Yeah, it's definitely more substantial than a lot of scenario-driven games. That's true.
And Space Hulk, the map changes.
Which
drastically changes everything. Yeah, and the victory condition, that'll change up the game drastically as well.
But why aren't you playing Suicide Mission?
This is also, because I just played Suicide Mission. Now we're moving on to the next one. Same
no,
days,
no, then you swap
same
sides.
Sessions.
You swap sides.
Yeah, well, then after that.
Okay.
This is the day of Space Hulk.
Okay, this is the third game. Okay, for your third game of Space Hulk, yes, start to investigate the other scenarios, absolutely.
All right, the next thing I have up is not really a category. It's just I want to make sure we talked about the difference between random things that are random and things that are variable.
Yeah.
Right, because randomness, someone's going to say, well, you know, any game, well, this time the cards came up off the deck in a different order or blah, blah, blah. And the variable, you know, you have things that are like Gaia Project. There is sort of a victory point thing for every round of the game. And that is variable. It's not, you know, random. And so you can sort of plan your game out. It's like, this is the turn I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this turn. There's no reason for me to do this turn. I'm going to save my resources and put out my buildings next turn where I'm going to get the extra bonus victory points.
Sure.
So things that are not sort of, people say things are replayable. They say, well, this time I'm going to do A, B, and C. Well, next time we're going to do CBA.
Exactly.
Which is exactly, you've already talked about this. It's the same thing, it just mixes up. And I have examples of this. Teotihuacan does a bunch of different things.
Yeah.
But some good and some bad. I feel as though the board randomization just
doesn't add much.
It just means you're either slowing the game down or speeding the game up. It's like, okay, well, I need stone first to build the temple. Well, then I'll just have to do a lap, get the stone, and then it'll just slow the game down.
Yeah.
Whereas they have tiles for the top of the tracks that will drastically change each game up. Anyway.
Yeah, good point, because it's fundamentally altering the victory conditions and what things are worth pursuing. It's true. Yeah, a lot of Euros have a lot of, you know, surface-level variability. That's fine. Again, like, you know, Voyages of Marco Polo is another great example, right? You're going to be putting out different city cards for all the cities. And yeah, that might completely change what is a good decision about where to go and when. But at the end of the day, the fundamental economy of the game isn't going to be shifting. The fundamental nature of the dice placement isn't going to be changing. It mostly just changes the contours of how you're going to go about doing something you were going to be doing anyway. And I'm perfectly happy to play games like that. I'm perfectly happy to replay games like that. But it is not, you know, to my mind, the pinnacle of replayability is when the choices other players make introduce radical new pressures into the system that force you to accommodate, and which leads me actually to an entire class of game that tends to have this in spades, which we haven't talked about at all, and that is auction games. A well-done auction game is going to have a radically different economy from game to game, whether it's a cube rails game and the stocks are going cheap or they're going really expensive, and that in turn influences the overall economy of how much money people have, whether it's a game like Modern Art, where you can have, literally, you can have mini, like bulb hysterias and tulipomanias, where it's like, oh, this artist, we really have to buy this artist. It's like, no, you don't. It's fine. And capitalizing on that is one of the things that I love about an auction game, how different every economy can be. It's almost like its own little story.
Two other sort of categories are just things that are outside the box. Just games that are so short, it doesn't matter.
Sure.
They just play through so quickly. Like, let's bring up Harmonies again. You guys started Harmonies. we did the game explanation and played a three-player game in 45 minutes.
Yes, and I think a solid 15 minutes of that was you standing over her shoulder saying, oh, that's really cool. Oh, that's great. Okay, well, I love that part. Oh, look, that's so good. Yeah.
I have not been able to play it with other players in real life. It's always been on Board Game Arena. So I'm sorry that I was excited. Anyway, so I'm sure that you guys had chit-chat at the beginning.
I don't talk to
you. And then there was a game explanation. So it was probably even shorter than 45 minutes, teach and play.
Sure.
It just plays so quickly. The deck of the animals is still fairly large, but you are going to, you know, eventually see the same animals over and over again.
Yes.
But I feel it plays so quickly that it just does not matter.
Sure.
Then the games that have just like the flow, same thing. They play short. Ethnos is what came to mind when I was thinking about this, that sure, it sort of plays the same every time, but it moves so quickly and so fast that it just sort of makes the game interesting every time you play.
Sure. And games that, you know, I've been saying over and over, yeah, this game has a fair amount of replayability, but not at the top tier. I'm perfectly happy to replay even games that play out the same way sometimes. Like a lot of no luck, vaguely deterministic games shake out very similarly from play to play. My favorite of that is probably Antica. I'm not saying that every game works out exactly the same way, but it is the case that there are standard openings because it's a no-luck economy driven by an efficiency engine. And I just like the fact that it's integrated with a whole bunch of mechanisms that I find pleasing. And yeah, you have to respond to player pressures. But at the end of the day, Antica tends to shake out roughly at the same tempo. And so I, you know, the replayability comes from that thing that we identified right at the beginning, just the quality of the design rather than any part of the design that leads to replayability.
I just have two games from the same designer. I'm wondering if they bring up an interesting discussion. I have Feast for Odin versus Agricola, right? We have Feast for Odin that I feel plays very similar every time.
Yes.
They have this huge card system, but the cards are so
situational and incidental
and inconsequential that it doesn't matter. And then we have Agricola, which is a very, you know, by the same designer, worker placement where all the places matter. The cards are usually fairly deterministic. And I just thought that was a very interesting two games to put against each other for replayability.
You're right. Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why I prefer Agricola over Feast for Odin.
And then there's just another genre of games that I think is, they go in their own category, and they will just have ultimate replayability, and that is each and every Splatter game. There are so many sort of intricate paths and different things you can do, like Food Chain Magnet.
Yeah.
People start buying different sort of milestone cards.
Yep.
That's going to totally turn the direction that the game goes.
And the economy that is generated by people's choices forces you to adapt and react. And, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and all Splatter games are like that. It's sort of like a sandbox that you just sort of, the game develops as you play it.
I wouldn't say all of them, but the ones that I prefer tend to. Like Roads and Boats, for example, it struck me as far too much like a puzzle. Similarly, Antiquity, although I enjoy it a great deal, I find is a little bit more accommodating to staged openings to sort of fix sort of like, well, first you do A, then B, then C, then D, then E. And it's a little more multiplayer solitaire. But yeah, I think that at their best, Splatter games, as typified by Food Chain Magnet, are very much in the category of replayability driven by player choices. That's going to be it for this week for So Very Wrong About Games. Thank you very, very much for joining us. We appreciate it a great deal. Please take care of yourselves, take care of your hobby, and as always, thank you, Rules Explainer. We hope to see you again soon.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Bickman. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. What are your self-care non-negotiables? It's hard to make time for the things that keep you healthy, but being consistent with self-care is like working a muscle. And when life gets crazy, that muscle keeps you strong. Therapy is the ultimate self-care, and BetterHelp makes it easy to get started with affordable online sessions you can do from anywhere. Never skip therapy day with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com today to get 10% off your first month.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices,
plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.